This is Chris McGregor. The work of Discerning Hearts really could not continue without your prayers and support. Between now and December 31st, please consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift. Click the Donate button on discerninghearts.com or inside the Discerning Hearts free app. Your generous support will allow us to continue the programming you have come to expect from us, like those from Father Timothy Gallagher, Dr. Anthony Lillis, Monsignor John Esseff, Archbishop George Lucas, and so many more. Please prayerfully consider supporting our mission, which is dedicated to those on the spiritual journey. Thank you, and God bless from all of us at Discerning Hearts. DiscerningHearts.com presents St. Thérèse and Marie, the story of two cousins with Father Timothy Gallagher. Father Gallagher is a member of the Oblates of the Virgin Mary, a religious community dedicated to retreats and spiritual formation, according to the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola. Father Gallagher is featured on several series on the EWTN television network, including Living the Discerning Life. He's the author of numerous books on the teachings of St. Ignatius of Loyola, as well as on the teachings of Venerable Bruno Lanteri, founder of the Oblates of the Virgin Mary. St. Thérèse and Marie, the story of two cousins with Father Timothy Gallagher. I'm your host, Chris McGregor.
Well, this next quotation is from 2 months after Marie's profession of vows, which was on March 25th of this year, 1897. So we are now on June 2nd, a couple of months later, and this is the day that Marie receives the veil. So the way this was done in Thérèse's time was that there were two ceremonies when a sister made her definitive commitment to the Carmelite life. The primary ceremony was the profession of vows, and these were perpetual vows. There were no temporary vows then. And this was done in private, in the presence of the community gathered in the choir, with the prioress presiding. So Marie has done this on March 27th. She is perpetually professed. But there is a second ceremony some weeks later, in which the sister receives the black veil, which is the visible sign of perpetual profession as a Carmelite. So she no longer will wear the white veil, which is the sign of the novice, but she's now even visibly perpetually professed. And this is what happens on June 2nd. So this is a ceremony, and this is public. This is in the church where the public can attend. So the family is there. There is a visit in the speak room afterward, and it's later in the day now, and this is Pauline, Mother Agnes of Jesus, who is sending this note to Thérèse. And what she's discussing here with Thérèse is, should I ask the prioress, Mother Marie de Gonzague, to give you the obedience to continue the writing of the story of your life, which had stopped at her entrance into Carmel? And she really wants this. She sees it as valuable, but she hesitates because she doesn't know if she's going to be tiring Thérèse too much by asking this. Is it worthwhile my asking our mother for the continuation of the little life, with a capital L? I fear that if she agrees, this will tire you out, even that it may be impossible for you to do it. Your condition is worsening so much. In point of fact, the following day, Mother Marie de Gonzague does give that order to Thérèse, and that's why we have the final chapters of the story of a soul, what is called Manuscript C. And Thérèse writes this at some cost to herself because her energies are waning. She writes in June, she'll also talk about the frequent interruptions from the sisters who are just wanting to be charitable and distract her. She's unable to move. She's in that extended sort of wheelchair that her father used and that she's now using. And she continues the writing into July, when finally her energy just gives out and she's simply unable to continue. And you note this even in the writing in the manuscript, because at a certain point, she's just too weak to manage the pen and the ink and all of that. And the last part of it is written in a rather shaky, trembling hand in pencil, until finally she has to stop. But at this point, Pauline, Mother Agnes of Jesus, is wondering whether she should go ahead with this. And then she says more personally, "When I think you are about to die, I would have really been happy to have something from you this year. I mean the continuation of your little life. That is, I'd really love to see this story of your life continue in writing. I no longer know what position to take. I would like to let you leave, that is, to go to the Lord, and at the same time keep you here. I still did not know how much I loved you." In fact, Pauline will be the one who, in a primary way, will accompany Thérèse through the final months. Her sister Céline will also be very close to her because when she entered, they assigned her to the infirmary. And I haven't seen this said in the writing, but I could well imagine that having seen her care of her father over those 6 years, they must have felt that she was well able to do this and to do it well. So for that reason, too, she will be very close to Thérèse throughout the final months. And then a reference to Sister Marie of the Eucharist, our Marie. "Sister Marie of the Eucharist really tired me out just now with her chatter over her scruples. I almost had a lump in my throat from it." So in the midst of all of this, of course, it's Marie's veil day and the visit with the family, Thérèse, the worries about her health, what to do about the story of a soul, all of this. And then, do I want to let you go to the Lord? Do I want you to stay? I'm just realizing how deeply I love all of this going on. And Marie comes to her and is pouring out the story of her scruples and her woes and her troubles and her sorrows. And Pauline is finding this almost unbearable. You just get the sense that without expressing it, she would just want to say, "Back off. This is not the time to stop." And then Pauline continues, "I can imagine what you suffered from her." So in the same way, you know, as assistant novice mistress, her formator, and she is coming in your regular meetings, as Thérèse is meeting with all five of the novices, and always the same story and the same woes and the same sorrows and the same doubts and the same confusions and burdens and so forth. "I can imagine what you suffered from her." You know, this is why I said earlier that Marie is, she's everyone. She's all of us. She loves the Lord. She's giving her life to the Lord, but she has her human weaknesses. "I can imagine what you suffered from her, but all that is over." Of course, with her current condition of health, Thérèse is no longer able to accompany the novices. "And what a beautiful crown has been made for you." So the love you've shown, the patience to carry Marie and the others, "what a beautiful crown has been made for you." Now, we'll be looking at some of this a bit later, but the editors here insert one of these remembrances of Thérèse by Marie, referring to this time when they're together in the Carmel and Thérèse is the assistant novice mistress. So let's quote it here. It comes well here. "How many times she spoke these words to me. I beg you, be busied a little less with yourself. Occupy yourself with loving God and forget about yourself." So that's the shift that Marie needs to make. Don't get caught up in this vortex of your worries and did I? And remember how we've seen earlier that she feels that she's sin seriously when they're in Paris and she shouldn't go to communion and all of this going on. So this is Thérèse's basic answer to her. Be busied a little less with yourself. Occupy yourself with loving God and forget about yourself. All your scruples, these are just a lot of self-seeking. So that's pretty blunt and pretty forthright. And it's right. It's the message that Marie needs to hear. And I think I've quoted earlier how one of the best commentators on Thérèse, Bishop Guy Gaucher, comments that Thérèse's guidance for these novices can be summed up in two words. It was firm, and that's what you see here, and it was tender. It was affectionate, and the novices knew that. And that's a pretty good recipe for raising children, for any responsibility that we have. And I think we can add maybe another quality too, and that it was wise in the sense that it was perceptive. Therese understands and knows well the person that she has before her. And what comes to mind as I'm saying that is Therese's comment to one of her sisters in another setting that no two people can be loved in the same way. Each person is different, and love needs to take a different shape for each person. And Therese is a master at this. She just does this to perfection. So she goes on to say, your griefs, your sorrows, all that is centered on yourself. And here's an image. It is like spinning around on the same pivot, which is pretty good. You know, you wind up one of these spinning tops and it starts spinning and all this energy and motion and movement, and it's going nowhere. It's just all staying in the same place. I beg you, and then this sums up everything here. I beg you, forget yourself. Think of saving souls. She used to be repeating this every time I was with her for direction, and that's notable. Every time they meet, over and over again, this is what Therese is saying to her. Forget yourself. Think of saving souls, which is the great apostolic center for Therese. This is why we're in Carmel. This is why we're in the heart of the church, which is love. Because by living the day with its many occupations and its small struggles and joys and all that fill the day, by living that with all the generosity that we can for the Lord, which is the active part of the little way and something all of us can do. By doing that, we are assisting in Jesus' work of redemption, of salvation. Souls will be saved eternally if we live that way. And that's the real focus. So think less about yourself and all your woes and so on, and dedicate your energies in this outward apostolic sense. Live your day such that souls will be saved by the grace of your sacrifices, your prayer, your reaching out to people who may be difficult for you, extending yourself when it would be easier to pull back, and so forth. And that's a profound thing, because that's true of every vocation. And it brings to mind Zélie and something that she says in one of her letters, now Saint Zélie, obviously, that, and she says she was born to have children. And that is that her sister, her daughter's comment that she wanted children because they would be so many more souls to enjoy eternal life with God forever. So in whatever vocation, Therese, patron of the missions, you know, who never traveled anywhere outside the Carmel when she entered, it's that outward. You know, what also comes to mind is St. John Paul II's law of the gift. As long as we center on ourselves and seek to be happy by pursuing our own time, our own plans, our own projects, we'll never be happy. But when we make the gift of ourselves in love to another, family members, a spouse, children, students, that if we're teachers, people that we serve, a priest in his parish, a nun in her ministry, when we make the gift of ourselves in love, first of all to God, and then in God for others, a wonderful thing happens. We become happy. That's the law of the gift. He who would save his life will lose it. It's that whole gospel paradox. And that's the whole direction in which she's urging Marie to travel. So that's just a glimpse of Marie in these last few years and under Therese's guidance. Now, the next thing we're going to look at is actually stepping back chronologically, because we move now into the final months of Therese's life and the culminating part of this relationship of these two cousins. Therese has about 4 months left to live at this point. We're in June of 1897, and this will be the summit of everything. As she lives her little way, as she wants to die of love, all the different things, she's a victim of merciful love, all these things that are occurring in her life, and then the darkness of faith and the what become at times just simply atrocious physical pains in the course of these months. But so that's going to take center stage in this final stage of their relationship. Final with an asterisk, because after Therese's death, Marie in the Communion of Saints has a very lively relationship with Therese, which continues, and she'll frequently refer to Therese and things that she said and favors that she's receiving and so forth. But in terms of when they're both together living, in this world, this is the final stage. But Thérèse's illness doesn't begin only in these final months. And I want to quote just one letter, which takes us back 3 years. So at this point, Céline has entered the Carmel, Marie has not. And she has just had a visit in the speak room. Thérèse has been there. And Marie writes to Céline to express her concern about what the state of health of Thérèse. So this is October 21st, 1894. I hope my little Thérèse takes care of herself. Yesterday, I found her voice noticeably changed. And the sisters noted this, actually, that Thérèse's voice, and this is for several years before the final illness, that her voice would get hoarse at times, and quite frequently. I have spoken to Francis, so that's Jeanne's husband, Francois, who is the doctor. I have spoken to Francis about her. It is absolutely necessary for her to look after herself properly. At present, it is nothing serious, but it could become so at any time, and then there would no longer be any cure to help her, and that's Marie's worry. Marie is very alive to medical things. She's the daughter of a pharmacist. She's the sister-in-law of a doctor. And she has been the one who has helped her mother. Her mother, Céline, had poor health and at times would need care. And Marie was the one who would come to the fore. I know I mentioned earlier that Francois, Jeanne's husband, was called the big doctor, and Marie's nickname was the little doctor. So she has, in fact, in her letters in these months, you really see an attention to medical detail that you don't get in the other letters, which is another reason why it's kind of providential that she was there as a witness at that time, because many of the strictly medical details that we have, her symptoms day by day, and then the various remedies the doctors tried, we have those from her letters. So at this point, she's saying that she can very well get better now if she takes constant care of herself, but she really needs to do that. She needs above all frequent gargles, so that remedy. My little Thérèse must obey the doctor's instruction. Francis specializes in these diseases. And so the commentator here raises a question. Had Francis already diagnosed at this stage what the illness was? It's noteworthy that nobody, at least in all of the records we have, ever used the word tuberculosis until Francois uses it in mid to late August when he has a visit. What happens is that the regular physician, Dr. de Cornier, is on vacation, and so Francis comes to visit Thérèse, which he does several times. And then Marie writes a letter to her parents, who are also away at this time, and uses the word tuberculosis, which it's the first time that we have it. And we'll come back to that in a minute. I believe what he says, Francis, and have confidence in him. He cured Monsieur Ferroul of a very serious complaint. Was it tuberculosis? She doesn't specify. He will also cure my little Thérèse. And then at the end of the letter, P.S., Papa, so that's the pharmacist Isidore, insists that Thérèse be well cared for. When I spoke to him of her, he seemed worried. Now, as I mentioned, we're blessed to have a witness of Marie in these months. In these months between June and September, we have 19 letters that Marie wrote to her parents about Thérèse's situation. This is the summer, and in the summer, as usual, her parents go to the chateau of La Muse, and so they're not in Lisieux, and so Marie, and she's given permission, which is another blessing, and another thing for which we need to thank Mother Marie de Gonzague, to keep them abreast almost daily sometimes of Thérèse's situation. And when they return from La Muse, they have a difficult choice to make, the parents, her parents, because Isidore suffers a great deal from gout. And in a way that was very common at the time, they would go to the waters of Vichy, V-I-C-H-Y in France, which was widely utilized as a health resort. So bathing in the waters, drinking the waters, and he would find some relief there. They're back from La Muse, Therese's situation is what it is. They just don't know. Should we go? Should we not go? But this is where you get this in and out, up and down, these fluctuations of Therese's illness. There are times when they, in July, there was a point when they just all were convinced she was going to die, and then she came back from it. Came back, relatively speaking, the worst of it subsides, but the tuberculosis is still taking its course with its accompanying symptoms. And so finally, after much hesitation, her parents do decide to go to Vichy. And in a way, that's a blessing for us because Marie continues to write letters. Once they do return to Lisieux, there are no more letters because they can actually come and visit at the... But so we have 19 of these letters. And as I just mentioned, she writes these with the sort of somewhat trained eye of one who is used to physical things and has been around doctors and pharmacy throughout her life. Now, it's too much for us to go through all of them. It would take us too long. But if you do want to read them, they're readily accessible. They're on the website of the Carmel of Lisieux. And they're also reproduced in the significant parts as regards Therese's situation in the book Last Conversations, and you can find them there. So I'm going to make a selection of letters and even just some parts of letters for the sake of time here. All right, this is 3 days after that June 2nd, the day of the reception of the veil that we spoke of. And she's writing to her parents. My dear little father, that's that repeated endearing little that's always there. Our little sister Therese of the Child Jesus is really very sick, and we are deeply disturbed. Dr. de Cornière is another player in all of this. He had a son, Joseph, who was a priest, and they were good friends of the Guérins. In fact, there are some of the photos of Joseph there with the Guérin family at Lamuse. And Dr. de Cornière was a doctor who served the poor without charging anything. And he was the regular doctor for the Carmel, which was a very poor Carmel, as I've mentioned before. And so it was a great blessing for them to have this doctor who was willing to provide his services without charge. And he also, with time, became a good friend of the prioress, Mother Marie de Gonzague. So he is the regular doctor assisting Therese throughout these months. Dr. de Cornière has come to see her this morning. She's up and around, so Therese at this point is still able to walk. But she's experiencing a general state of weakness. She herself now realizes that she's very ill. In point of fact, I think you'd have to say that Therese knew it before anyone else did. But she, if you read her letters, for example, throughout even these last months, there is maybe one reference to her own health in the course of it. And if I remember well, that's to the seminarian or the young priest to whom she's writing, letting them know. There's kind of farewell letters but basically it's just astounding that here she is gravely ill and there's no reference to it. In fact, when she had those hemoptyses, the coughing up of blood, the preceding year on a Holy Thursday night and Good Friday, she never said anything to anyone except to the superior, about that. Pauline only learned about it months later. And Therese did that because she just didn't want Pauline worrying. She feels sharp pains in her side and can hardly eat anything. I fear I'm disturbing you, dear father, but we are very much upset. If you could only see the progress her illness has made in 1 week, and even since I received the veil, which was 3 days earlier, and things have worsened since then. She's in a state of great exhaustion. She feels at times, as she tells us, agonies, as though she were going to die. She feels that life is leaving her. So you have all the symptoms of tuberculosis, very high fever. She would sweat profusely. And there were times when, day after day, and sometimes repeatedly in the day, she would cough up blood. That continued. She lost weight. She was becoming emaciated. What was striking about this was that her face remained essentially unchanged throughout the illness. In fact, if you look at the photos, you'd have no idea from her face that she's ill. The only place you could see it, because the habit covered everything else, was the thinness of her hands. I mean, so little did it show, and she worked so much at being cheerful that many of the sisters never really believed that she was that ill until well into the illness, when it became as apparent as it did. Would Mama please send us some little dishes for her? And this is another reason why Marie has permission to write, because Isidore and Celine are the great, really the only benefactor of the Carmel at this time, and they are constantly purchasing remedies from the pharmacy for her, or sending food that they think is going to be good for her. They're constantly doing this, and so Marie is the one who is asked to write to thank them, and as she does this, she updates them on Therese's situation. She, that is, her mother Celine, will be able to choose nice things which will do our little angel some good. I believe she is going to fly away to heaven very soon. She said last night, "I will be content to die or to live, for I will only what God wills. Everything is for her love." Not said so simply there, but if you read the last conversations, it took Therese a while to reach this point where she was just completely abandoned. If you want me to live, I'll live. If you want me to die, I'll die. Part of it was because the sufferings were so great as she went through this, that the thought of going through all of this and not dying became burdensome, in a sense that I would have to do all this again, you know, at some point. But and then the times when she's convinced she's about to die, and then she has a recovery, and then the relapses, and finally, I know I quoted earlier when she says to Pauline, "You can worry about dates. I'm through with that. I've been, you know, prepared for death and then let down, and this has happened so often that I'm simply abandoned." No. This next letter is a month later, and so we are into July now. And July, August, September, this is the real height of the tuberculosis. So July 8th, 1897. "Dear little father, I come to give you news of your little queen's health. The news is more and more disturbing. Yesterday, Dr. de Cordonnier came twice during the day. He's terribly worried." And then she writes, "It's not tuberculosis, but an accident which happened to the lungs, a real lung congestion." Now, just a comment on that, because that's obviously wrong. It very much was tuberculosis. And Bishop Gaucher comments that there are two ways to understand this. One is that in the state of medicine in 1897, with regard to tuberculosis, it was not impossible that a doctor could misdiagnose the symptoms. If that's true, however, you have to deal with the fact that Dr. de Cordonnier, although in no case do we see him using the word tuberculosis, prescribes all of the remedies that were prescribed for tubercular patients at the time. So his treatment of it is the treatment that would be given to tuberculosis. The second hypothesis is that it was a deliberate choice not to use the word. You know, in the way today, for example, that when you get tests back from the doctor and it turns out to be cancer, and you want to find a gentler way to say it to the person so that the person won't be so crushed. But tuberculosis was a powerful word at the time. There was no remedy for it. And it was painful, and it would lead to death. And so it's quite likely that everyone around Therese was taking that approach, that they just wouldn't use the word. So like Marie here, they speak of a chest complaint and so forth. Whichever of those hypotheses is the case, when we get to August, so we're in the second half of August, and she dies September 30th. At this point, Dr. de Cordonnier goes on vacation with his family. And so you have this space where Therese, and it's in the worst of her sufferings when she doesn't have a doctor. It's a very painful time for her. But Francis, the Dr. Francois Lanel, he does come in the latter part of August, and they allow him to visit. And it's quite striking, actually. Again, it would take us too much time, but he writes a letter to Isidore and Celine describing this. When he is in there, he asks for permission and doesn't wait for an answer, and he kisses Therese, you know, on the forehead. He just wants to do that. But when Marie writes to her parents after his visit, she says this: he told us that the tuberculosis had reached its final stage. So Francois is using that title, the word, at this point. But earlier, as far as we know, the word hasn't been used. And then he also, as Marie tells her parents, indicates to them that because of the advanced stage of the disease, there really was nothing he could do for Therese at this point. And as I say, there was no cure for it at that time. And then a number of the physical details. Yesterday, she coughed up blood twice, and all through the remainder of the day, she was coughing up blood. So we can just imagine what Therese is going through in this illness. You know, Bishop Gaucher says at one point that you can really only fully understand Therese when you see how she lived the last 6 months of her life. It's the apex. It's when she's living all the insights, but living them now in a situation in which she is supremely tried. Another of his comments is worth mentioning too, that you can think of a person who is suffering just terrible, terrible physical pain, let's say from an illness, and you can think of another person who has no physical pain, but is suffering terribly on the spiritual or moral level, emotionally, some terrible burden. Therese has both. Therese has both. She is in that deep darkness of, on the level of faith, making acts of faith, she says, more than she ever has before, writing out the creed in her blood, even. This is the warrior standing strong, both physically and interiorly, emotionally, spiritually, in great pain. Dr. de Cornier, yesterday morning, you know, that's the answer to any remaining misconception of Therese as a pampered child in a loving family and in whose life everything was sweetness. That's completely wrong about every stage of her life, beginning with age 4 when her mother dies, and then she has the illness and all the rest of that. But it's also commentary on the full name. She is Therese of the Child Jesus and of the Holy Face. And in fact, I know we've talked about this elsewhere, says to her sister Pauline at one point that it's that the latter phrase that is the real center of her spirituality. Yes, she does live with that childlike spirit and the simplicity in her relationship with the Lord. But the deepest center of her whole spirituality, as she said, is the Holy Face. And by that she means Isaiah 53, there was no beauty in him to make us look at him. He was struck down. For the Holy Face for her is that image of Jesus in his passion. And you see her living that in these months.
We'll return to Saint Therese and Marie, the story of two cousins, with Father Timothy Gallagher in just a moment. Did you know that Discerning Hearts has a free app where you can find all your favorite Discerning Hearts programming? Father Timothy Gallagher, Dr. Anthony Lillis, Monsignor John Essef, Deacon James Keating, Father Donald Haggerty, Mike Aquilina, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and so many more. They're all available on the free Discerning Hearts app. Over 3,000 spiritual formation programs and prayers, all available to you with no hidden fees or subscriptions. Did you also know that you can listen to Discerning Hearts programming wherever you download your favorite podcasts, like Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, even on Audible, as well as numerous other worldwide podcast streaming platforms? And did you know that Discerning Hearts also has a YouTube channel? Be sure to check out all these different places where you can find Discerning Hearts Catholic podcasts dedicated to those on the spiritual journey.
Discerning Hearts provides content dedicated to those on the spiritual journey. To continue production of these videos, prayers, and more, go to discerninghearts.com and click the donate link found there or inside the free Discerning Hearts app to make your donation. Thanks, and God bless.
We now return to Saint Therese and Marie, the story of two cousins, with Father Timothy Gallagher. Portrait you're giving us is one we don't hear about very often. the image that you described of the little girl who had maybe a little precocious, threw herself down at the feet of the Pope. I mean, the surface expression of her, and even living out the little way. Sometimes, you know, we don't have that deep, deep sense of the cross that she's carrying during those later months. I mean, you're beginning to really shine a light in an area. And I wonder, my question is, Father, why do you suppose after all this time that isn't more of a focus when the conversation's about Therese? That image, we always see the passion of Christ and we gaze upon the crucifix. And that we understand that suffering. I don't know, though, when we gaze upon the images of Therese, I don't know if we have that type of comprehension of her passion.
Yes, I think the reason for that, I can say there are two reasons. Therese dies in 1897, and she's canonized in 1925. Until that point, what we know as the Book of Her Last Conversations was unpublished. These last conversations, in great part, were written by Pauline. So day by day, she accompanies Therese. And even as they're together, she has a notebook and she's writing down the things that Therese says and does. I wonder what that cost Therese, you know, to have that happening. Pauline, at this point, has no idea that any of this will ever be published. They're just remembrances of her sister that she wants to keep. And so they're extensive. Day by day, sometimes you'll have 8-10 entries in the course of a day. And this is the central part of the Book of the Last Conversations. Céline did something similar, not quite as lengthy as Pauline, but she also did, and we have those in Last Conversations. And as I said, she was right there, and then she actually lived in the next room as the infirmarian to whom they'd essentially given over the care of Therese. And then you have shorter accounts of others, her novice sister Marie of the Trinity. Marie herself, as we'll see, wrote some of these, and then some others, her older sister Marie, and so on. But none of this was given to the public. And when it was then given to the public, it was the year after Therese was canonized, so it's in 1926, that Pauline, to whom we owe so much, people will sometimes criticize the selections that she made, but without Pauline, there would have been no Story of a Soul and all the rest that happened. And the same is true of these last conversations. Pauline, as she says, was of the opinion that the humanity of a saint should not be shown too much because it would disedify people. Bishop Gaucher comments that even though that was her stance, and that's where you get this sort of, oh, what would you say, a little, if I can invent a verb, angelized version of Therese a bit, you know. Even though that was her stance, and that's what she did in editing the writings, which Therese had given her permission to do, by the way. In her notebook where she's noting down the things Therese said and did, you absolutely see the humanity of Therese in a very profound way. So none of this was available early on. And when it was made available, it was made available without some of the kinds of details that we're sharing here. So I think it's really no fault on the public's part that they just simply didn't know this. What has changed all of this is that as the centenary of Therese's birth and then her death approached, so that would be 1973, the centenary of her birth, and then 1997, the centenary of her death. Bishop Guy Gaucher, whom I've been quoting, was a key player in this, and we really owe him an awful lot. But they got together a team. There was a Carmelite sister in there who was excellent at this kind of thing, and several others as well, and put together the project of a centenary edition of her works, which would be complete and would have all the scholarly apparatus and the notes and everything. And they did that. Just a magnificent, magnificent contribution to Therese. So that as that was completed, I believe it was in the 1990s it was completed, for the first time, we have access to Thérèse in a way that we never had before. And in fact, the editions of her writings that we read today, so the most common edition of The Story of a Soul, the one translated by Father John Clark, is taken from that centenary edition of the complete works. That was 8 volumes, the complete works of her writings. And the same thing with Last Conversations. He takes that from what we have in 1 volume as Last Conversations. In the centenary edition is 2 complete volumes because they added an awful lot of notes and complementary apparatus to it. So we have access to it now in a way, and that's pretty recent. You know, it's not many years ago that all of this was published, and that it took time also to get things translated and published in English, and not everything has been translated yet into English, but all of the significant things have. So it's only recently that we've had this kind of access to Thérèse. So it's there. I mean, that's where I'm finding it. But you have to read. You have to go back to the sources, which we now can do in a way that even 30 years ago would not have been possible for us. And now you can see the humanity of Thérèse. And what happens is, not only is she not diminished by it, but she's made all the more approachable and lovable, I would say, and real. And I've said earlier, and I'll say again, that maybe this would be a third reason if you want. I don't think you ever get to the bottom in Thérèse. Bishop Guy Gaucher will say this too. He speaks of her personality as fascinating and mysterious. And again, I'd say he's right on the money with this. The deeper you get into Thérèse, in a sense, you say, oh, I had no idea. And you know you're not at the bottom yet. I'm kind of, you know, in a much more humble way, I very much subscribe to what Bishop Guy Gaucher says. I'm resigned to the fact that I'll never get to the bottom of Thérèse, which is a happy problem, because there's always more to discover. Let's keep in mind, too, that all that we're saying here, we're only looking at one small thread in Thérèse. This is her relationship with her cousin. That's all we're looking at. And it's just opening up so much more. That's my problem, by the way. I have to stop myself from keep going on.
Well, I just have to also ponder the role of the church in her canonization, not wanting every scrap of paper from Pauline and Céline, because Céline kind of held some stuff back too. It wasn't until after her death, if I'm not correct in that, but it was they were able to get to what was left. And again, remembering, they're the ones that actually wrote everything down. So that's really good. I'm surprised that the church didn't say we want every scrap of paper. In many ways, that's the demand today for those who may be brought forward for an examination for canonization, serve their process of either servant of God. They want to see they would like to see everything, so that they can assess it properly.
Oh, sure. You know, actually there were 2 processes. There was the one for her beatification. So you have all the witnesses and examination of everything. That takes place locally up in Lisieux and the area. It's in the diocese. And then you have the 2nd process, which takes place down at Rome. And so the 1st process leads to her being declared venerable, you know, the heroicity of her virtues and that her writings are without error. And then the 2nd to her beatification and her canonization. So all of this is done in great depth. But Thérèse, you know, apart from The Story of a Soul, which they published after her death, Thérèse never published anything. You know, so it's not like John of the Cross, you know, who has several books published during his lifetime and so forth. And we're talking here, there are thousands of letters, for example, if we look at all the letters of the different family members to each other and so forth. They would have gone through the writings to a point in which they were sure that there was no error here. And then to her life, to the point where they could certify that there was heroic virtue here. That's what they do in the process. But I don't think you can ask the process to publish everything. If I look at our own founder's cause of canonization, for his being declared venerable. An extensive volume was published of his writings, selections of his writings, and then witnesses from various people. And I'd have to look at it again, but it's well over 1,000 pages. An enormous amount of work that went into this, to the point where they could say, yes, he lived with heroic virtue and his writings are without error. But if you were to read every single thing that he wrote, we have stacks and stacks and stacks of volumes of manuscript writings, many of which have not been published yet. You know, more has obviously since that time been published. Okay, well, let's pick up with the letter here then. This is July 8th. Dr. de Cornier yesterday morning forbade her to make any movements. It's just going to harm you because of the wound there. He won't even allow her to be taken down to the infirmary. And that would happen not much later, actually, until the wound in her right lung is healed. So they know the lung is affected. Nobody's calling it tuberculosis. But what's happening is, as these weeks are going by, the tuberculosis is gradually undoing the cells of the lung so that it's going to get harder and harder for her to breathe. Eventually, the right lung will be completely destroyed, and then the tuberculosis moves to the left. And finally, in the latter stages, she's struggling to breathe with about just a quarter of what we all have to breathe. So that process is happening. Although at this point, he's talking about that right lung being healed. She is constantly taking ice, a drink which is to stop the blood. Let me read a few more sentences here, and then I'll make a comment. I think, too, she's being given mustard poultices and mustard under other forms. The doctor is caring for her admirably. He applied 2 dry cups. Now, what does all that mean? Not only does Therese have these terrible physical pains as she's dying from the tuberculosis, but the remedies that were common in the medicine of the time, they make you wince, even just to when you hear what they are. So these mustard poultices, the belief was that if the skin blistered, it was going to ease the congestion in the lungs. And so they would apply hot mustard poultices to the skin, which would raise blisters. And we have comments that whenever they did this to Therese, it would take her a day to recover from it. And another seems, to, at least to me, even worse. It was called points of fire, pointe de feu. And in this, and we have counts of this, of Dr. de Cornier there, and you heat a needle, a pin, to when it's red hot, and then you apply it to the skin. And on one occasion, at least, this is done 500 times. And you have the Celine is holding Therese as all of this is happening. And again, the thought was that somehow this would cause the blood to circulate better, that would help with tuberculosis. This dry cups is another thing that is hard even to think of. And so, again, to the external skin, you apply a cup properly made out of glass or whatever. And then there are various ways of doing it. You withdraw all the air from it. And what that does is it causes the skin to blister.
Oh my gosh, it just freaks me out. Oh my goodness.
No, isn't it something?
Oh.
Since we're on this, I'll mention this now because it'll come up later. For about 3 of these months, Therese was put on what was called a milk diet. This goes back centuries, the thought that milk is helpful when a person has tuberculosis. I think today the doctors would simply say there's no basis to this, but it was common practice. That's what I mean earlier by saying that Dr. de Cornier was simply following the protocols that would have been followed with tuberculosis at the time. Therese had never been able to digest milk. She just couldn't keep it down. Milk was always painful for her whenever she was constrained to have it. And at this point, she's barely able to eat very much. And of course, that's a problem. I mean, that's where you get the loss of weight and becoming so emaciated. And so Dr. de Cornier does what any knowledgeable doctor at the time would have done, and that is he prescribes this milk diet. And this is a kind of milk which was obtained at the pharmacists, and in French, lait maternisé, maternalized milk in a clumsy transliteration. So it was heavier, it was more condensed than regular milk. And for 3 months, this was the diet Thérèse was on, until finally she was in such extreme pain toward the end that later in August, they finally allowed her to stop this. But this is from Pauline's notes, and this is July 3rd, so it's right around this time that we're reading this letter. And Pauline, this is one of these things she's writing down. It's there in the last conversations. Since milk made her sick, and since she was unable to take anything else at this time, Dr. de Cornier had prescribed a kind of condensed milk that was to be obtained at the pharmacist's under the name of lait maternisé. This prescription, for various reasons, caused her pain, and when she saw the bottles arrive, she began to shed, the translation here says warm tears, literally hot tears. Now this is Thérèse. Nobody ever knew what food she liked. She would eat anything. They always knew in the kitchen when there was food left that nobody would eat, they could give it to Thérèse and she would eat it. She had various allergies with regard to food. She never let the cooks know, and she would simply eat whatever. And this is Thérèse, who, when she sees these bottles of milk arriving, she begins to cry. It just tells us just how hard this was for Thérèse to have to absorb this milk diet, you know, on which she was given.
My daughter is lactose intolerant, and it's painful. I mean, she literally cries if she finds out that there's a substance that has milk products in it. And when they eat it, it literally causes severe cramping in the gut. My gosh, Father Gallagher, the girl's being tortured inside and out, literally.
Very much so. And you know, it brings to my mind the last months of Zélie as she dies from her breast cancer. She rightly never had any faith in any of the remedies the doctors proposed. She did have recourse to her brother Isidore, the pharmacist, get his advice and use some of the remedies that he suggested. And it's like mother, like daughter in the last months. And Zélie suffered terrible pain also in the last months as she died of cancer. There's one more thing to add here, and that is that morphine was known, you know, so a way of mitigating pain. And this is one of the difficult things in this. Was it appropriate for a religious woman to use a sedative like that, to use morphine? And we're still in the earlier stages of all of this. And the prioress, Mother Marie de Gonzague, just felt that it was not right for a nun to use that. And so Thérèse was never given a morphine injection. Toward the end, they would slip a little morphine syrup into some of her food or what she was taking in. And sometimes her sisters mentioned that they wouldn't tell the prioress, you know, that they were doing this. So essentially, she went through all of this without any painkiller, basically. Imagine going through cancer without a painkiller. So that's why I said earlier her sufferings were simply atrocious. Now, there were times of remission when the sufferings would come back down from that kind of peak torment. And that's why nobody quite understood all of this. But there were peak times, and in August especially, there were close to 2 weeks of just about the worst pain. Thérèse will say later, she said, I never dreamed that anyone could suffer this much. And remember how she also says, I don't know how people without faith don't commit suicide. And she says, don't leave the medications near me, because when the pain is so terrible, you'd do anything to be free. So from all of this, you know, she took this phrase from St. John of the Cross, to die for love, and she wants to die for love. And that gradually came to mean for her not the peaceful, gentle death that John of the Cross describes, but the death of love is Jesus on the cross. That's the death of love. Supreme love. And She wanted to be a martyr. I think you can say she was a martyr. I don't know how any martyr, how any martyr could have suffered more than Therese did in those months.
This isn't what classically is known as white martyrdom. People that will, you know, a different type of suffering. So many of it. I mean, just enduring the pain of just everyday life and witnessing the faith. But this is, I mean, especially when it's being inflicted upon you and you're engaging it, you're allowing it for a, in faith to witness and to do it for Christ. I'm not a scholar professional in the field of theology as you are, Father Gallagher. Boy, it sure screams red martyrdom to me.
Well, this is what I'm saying about there are depths in Therese that we have only begun to explore. Thank God we have access to them now because the sources are available to us. But when you get into them, yeah, you know, the image of Therese as the pampered, sweet saint who threw rose petals and all of that, that's so far removed from me now, I can't even remember seeing Therese that way. And we're blessed, actually, as I'm saying, that Marie, her cousin, was a witness to this, and she's the one who's giving us these details.
And it says a lot about Celine, too, if you don't mind me interjecting that real quick, because I've known people that have had to accompany in their life the suffering and dying of family members. And Celine literally had to witness not only her mother's at a young age and the death of siblings at a young age, but also accompanying her father for years. This wasn't a blink of an eye, and helping her sister process at Léonie, I'm speaking. But then to go immediately into the Carmel, and what's the first thing that happens? She ends up in a room right next to her beloved dying sister. There's a mystery right there.
Well, if we want to keep the chronology, this happens in Celine's third year in the Carmel. So she enters in 1894, okay. And this is 1897 when all of this happens for Celine. But that's a good observation that she has seen a lot of death. And not simply seen, but in terms of her father and Therese, she has accompanied it and watched it. You can read her reflections on all of this because, as I said, she too kept a notebook, and that's there in the last conversations. So Marie continues, this is July 8th. The doctor is caring for her admirably, etc. She had a very bad night, and this morning she was telling us that the souls in purgatory couldn't burn any more than she did. Her fever was so strong. In fact, the fever caused so much sweating that not only her habit, but even the mattress would be just soaked from her sweat, from the fever. And in addition, she was seized with fits of suffocation as her lungs are gradually deteriorating and breathing gets harder. Now, that's one side of it, the extreme pain at times, the constant suffering, and at times extreme pain that Therese endures, coupled with the spiritual darkness that she's undergoing. But the amazing thing is how Therese responds to this. That's why I think when we don't shortchange the physical sufferings, and I'm not going to keep repeating in all the letters all those details now that we've said them, but they are there all the way through. But the way she responds to this is just, I don't know, I have to say astounding. And this is where you see what the little way really can mean. When you can smile, be good to people who are causing you physical pain, though they don't know it, and do all of this in the daily things, even in circumstances like this. That's why I say, I think Bishop Gaucher is right when he says it's only in the last 6 months of her life that you really see the full depths of what all of these spiritual realities mean for Therese. So Marie goes on to say to her parents, when we visit her, we find her much changed, very emaciated, but she's always calm, always ready to joke. And that's not an exaggeration. Earlier, I've mentioned a few of the puns, and they're from these months. She sees death coming, and she's happy. She hasn't the least fear of it. This will sadden you, dear little father. And it's quite understandable. So I pause there for a moment because what Marie writes is true. It's almost true. She sees death coming and she's happy. She hasn't the least fear of it. There were a few times in the crushing burden of the darkness in which she felt abandoned by God and struggled even to believe that there was a heaven, which had been the goal of her whole life, when some fear did come in. There were some moments along the way. I would say that Marie's letters are slightly, how would you say? They're written, I would say, and Marie may not even be aware of it herself, but when you compare the kinds of things that we've just said with Marie's letters, I guess you'd say Marie doesn't fully understand the full depth of the suffering here and what's going on. But it's not Marie's fault in any way. I don't think anyone did. And Therese, if you will, is partly to blame for that because she wouldn't share some of this. She didn't want a burden. For example, her struggles with faith and so on, she was very cautious in even mentioning that because she didn't want anyone else to share those burdens. So much so that, for example, her sister Marie, the older sister, only learned of this when she read The Story of a Soul, you know. And even what she said to Pauline and so on was very, very limited. All of us will be losing the greatest of treasures, Therese, but she's not to be pitied. Loving God the way she does, how well received she'll be up there in heaven. She'll go straight to heaven, that is certain. To mention the state the community is in, there are tears, sobs, and grief on all sides. Mother Agnes of Jesus is to be admired for her courage and resignation as she accompanies Therese. Our Mother Prioress has a real motherly tenderness toward all of us in the midst of the greatest of pains, for Sister Therese of the Child Jesus was her greatest treasure.
You've been listening to Saint Therese and Marie, the story of two cousins, with Father Timothy Gallagher. Be sure to check out the comprehensive summary and reflection questions contained in the show notes for this episode. To download this particular episode, along with hundreds of other spiritual formation programs, visit discerninghearts.com, or you can find them within the free Discerning Hearts app or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. This has been a production of Discerning Hearts. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. We hope that if this has been helpful for you, that you will first pray for our mission, which is to offer authentic and rock-solid spiritual formation freely to souls around the world. And if you feel us worthy, please consider a charitable donation, which is fully tax deductible, to help support our efforts. But most of all, we hope that you will tell a friend about discerninghearts.com and join us next time for Saint Therese and Marie, the story of two cousins, with Father Timothy Gallagher.